Hey everyone, welcome to episode 105 of Medusa's Cascade, Collateral Damage, and the third arc episode. I'm your friendly neighborhood DM Tom, and I've got a few things to cover before we get into the speedrun of the next 7 episodes of the campaign. First and foremost, thank you for sticking with us for 104 episodes. It's still mind-boggling to think that we have that many episodes, and knowing what we've got in the can, we've got some content for a while now. Secondly, we are going to be switching to a bi-weekly format for this actual play, so not next week, but the week after, the fourth arc episode will be released. It will cover episodes 22 through 29. This is for logistical reasons and for some mental health reasons as well. But on the bright side, we will be premiering some new content starting at the beginning of the upcoming year, or rather, at the end of this current year. So on New Year's Eve, Across the Plains will be premiering. It'll be a bi-weekly show with myself and a couple of members from the cast on each episode, writing lore for the three prime material planes the campaign takes place in. It's pretty interesting, and I really like the aspect of the group world building. It's a really fun experience. I think you'll enjoy it. If you have the opportunity, please check out our social media accounts on most of the major platforms. Just search for the Medusa's Cascade on the platform and give us a follow. We'll have art and animatics from the early stages of the animation project that we've sort of spawned from this campaign. It's really cool stuff and definitely worth your time checking out. Finally, if you're listening on a streaming platform, especially Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please take a few minutes to rate, review, and subscribe. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it does help get the podcast out there to other people to discover, and we would really appreciate the love and support. So, without further ado, let's get to the third arc in this crazy, crazy campaign that we're in, called The Constable.
The party has a short rest and heads southwest to the Wizard of the Wines. After Wiaqua summons horses for the party, they turn themselves into a Clydesdale for Galahad to ride on. Kyver jokes, "Look who's giving who a ride now!" As they ride along, Zex uses Duo to look ahead, and he sees a manor covered in dead vines in the distance. Zex relays the information back to the team and asks Wiaqua if he could talk to plants once they're out of their horse form. They continue for a few more miles before reaching a crossroad, then head west towards the vineyard.
"Yes, let's go to the vineyard. Maybe they'll have some good wine," Kyver exclaims.
"These things never end well," Galahad warns. Argyle quips, "Cat, you know you have 9 lives, but
do you have 9 lives?"
"Well, I was up a drinking last night. I gotta empty my stomach earlier. The number 2 felt like a number 10, Kyver replies.
"Hopefully this place has toilet paper," Argyle shoots back. It starts to drizzle as they reach the vineyard. The party approaches a cloaked figure at the entrance.
"Shanks, are you feeling talkative?" Zex asks.
Shanks replies with, "I'll do my best." He greets the grizzled old man. He wants to know why the party is there. Shanks tells him that they're looking for the shipment of wine that was supposed to be delivered to the town nearby. The figure introduces himself as Damian Maltikov, the owner and head of the family who runs the vineyard. He continues that they're in the right place, but abominations from the woods and druids have taken over the winery. They look like dead trees and shrubs, but then they start to move. Shanks offers the party's help. Damian thanks them. Shanks asks, "Where can we find you when we're done?" To which Damian replies, "I'll be right here," before disappearing into the brush and vines. The party heads to the main building on the property, which they've been told has the most activity. As a precaution, Zek sends Duel up into the sky and scans the area. Unfortunately, Duel doesn't see anything. Making their way to the manor, trees, shrubs, and vines start to move towards them.
The party dashes for the stables to plan their attacks, but realize that Weeaqua isn't with them. They're making a charge at the enemy solo. Frustrated, the party rushes to fight with them. The battle ensues with multiple blights and druids. The enemy has surprise on their side. However, the party can set up in better tactical positions and are victorious. Duo, still in the sky at the end of the battle, informs Zex that there aren't any other blights, but there is a massive tree approaching them from the south. The team finds the barrels of wine and debates amongst themselves if they can take it back to the people. Zex leads the conversation and the team decides if it's ethical to take them without clearing the rest of the building. Kyver and a few others agree that the mission is to take the wine and go. Zex points out that every time they half-ass things, things go to shit. Kyver and Zex have a heated moral debate. Weeaqua, in their bear form during the battle, walks into the discussion. While everyone argues, Weeaqua raises their paw. The party stops and looks towards the bear. Argyle asks, "Yes, bear?" Franchise swoops down and sits on their shoulder. Through grunts and gestures, Weeaqua explains that Franchise can be a lookout when they finish the mission. Kyver sarcastically asks, "Does anyone speak bear?" Shanks quickly chimes in and explains they decide to split the party and explore the winery fully, hoping to rid the place of its problem.
They split into equal groups of three. Making their way quickly around the building, they find two other entrances beside the front door. They make a plan to breach all the doors at the same time. Almost immediately, they're caught in a small skirmish with vine blights and more druids. But because their initial stealth and advantage on the surprise, all of these scuffles are short-lived. Once the building is cleared, the party searches it for anything that may be valuable and, well, won't be missed. Finding empty wine bottles, Argyle and Kyver decide to fill a couple with fermenting casks as a celebratory drink. Unfortunately, the wine has been poisoned by the druids and make the two extremely sick. Seeing them both in dire straits, Galahad uses Lay on Hands to bring them back to health. Atros, Argyle, and Weeaqua hear the telltale signs of the Medusa's Cascade appearing outside. They inform the rest of the party and make their way out from the interior of the winery, following the lumbering black bear form of Weeaqua. The drizzle that had started earlier had now turned into a steady rain. Thick droplets fall hard on their collective heads as they trudge their way through the winery grounds, littered with corpses of vines, needles, and twig blights alike. They focus on the tavern ahead of them in the distance. Closing in on the familiar building, they begin to sense that something isn't right. One by one, they all begin to notice signs of a battle, but not the one they had just finished.
Zex breaks into a dead sprint towards the sanctuary of the group's benefactor, with the rest of the party in hot pursuit. Step by step, the scene becomes clearer. Scorch marks streak across the exterior of the tavern, smoldering in the now driving rain. The ranger skids to a stop in front of the door, turning and working the handle to no avail. As the party begins to crowd around the entrance, each trying in vain to open the door, a faint rumble makes its way closer. "Clear a path," roars I. As he charges towards the door, the party parts just in time to witness a streak of metallic blue light make contact with the locked entryway. With a nearly loud crash, the paladin, myself, bursts into the tavern, its interior in even more disarray. The rest of the party follows me into a scene of chaos and near destruction. Scorch marks litter the walls and tables, and chairs lay in splinters and chunks on the floor. There is a brief calm that comes over everyone as they take in the scene until Kyver hears a small crash towards the back, seemingly coming from the journeyman's office. Pushing through his compatriots, the tabaxi makes his way toward the doorway. This door is also locked. Acting quickly, the rogue pulls out his thieves' tools and makes quick work of the lock. By this time, the rest of the party is on his heels as he bursts into the almost untouched office. "Please don't," they all hear from the back corner of the room, recognizing the voice as the bartender, Welby. "Welby, brother, what happened?" Kyver asks his friend as he reaches the halfling's hiding spot. "He's gone. They took him," Welby whimpers. "Who's gone?" Zex questions. "The journeyman. He's gone. They took him."
After finding Welby in the journeyman's office, the party begins to ask questions. The interior of the tavern looks like a battle scene. Welby tells the party that he knows who took him and where he's being held, but before he discloses the information, he implores the party to take a rest and let him clean the place up and collect himself. Shanks pulls Zex to the side and gives him a rundown of the plan that's been formulated in his head. He explains that the journeyman is key to stopping Strahd, using the tavern to bring them back to the point in time when Irina was taken and getting her back. "That doesn't happen without the journeyman," Shanks emphasizes. "This fucks everything if we can't find him." Zex agrees, but doesn't want to put his faith in a plan that might not happen. Before the rest of the party heads off to bed, Zex pulls Glad aside and asks her about her relationship with the gods, her parents, and her faith. She believes that her father is the Green Man, or the Green Lord. The two converse and get to know each other a little bit better. He eventually makes his way up to his room after helping Welby clean up the tavern. The party reconvenes the next day in the tavern and finds a stranger at the bar, a taller half-orc with a pseudo-dragon familiar. He calls himself Revan Akbar. Welby explains that he is a former traveler with the journeyman and is there to help the party get him back. Revan is understandably cautious around the party, but settles in pretty quickly. After some interesting interactions between Revan and the rest of the party, Welby begins to explain the situation. He and the journeyman have been traveling for close to 6 months when they were raided by a group run by a being known as the Constable.
The journeyman gave themselves up to prevent any bloodshed. Welby goes on to explain that the journeyman was arrested for crimes of disruptions in time, and multiple others across several planes. He's unaware of whether or not these crimes are legitimate, but the journeyman was taken and is being held in a place called the Vaults. Welby continues that he feels it's best course of action to split into two groups, a stealth team to infiltrate the Vaults and break the journeyman out, as well as a negotiation team to try and appeal to the Constable in a more political way for the journeyman's release. The party asks about the Constable, but Welby only has heard the name. He speculates that he may be the same ancestry as the journeyman. Welby goes on to tell the party that from what he knows, the Vaults are its own pocket plane. It's a prison meant to hold time travelers. The group agrees that a split may be the best route and begins to discuss who should be in what group. After a long back and forth, the party decides to split into almost the same way they did to investigate the strange tower of Barovia, but with one key difference. Zex and Wiakwa would switch places. To keep contact, Revan and Wiakwa would each exchange familiars. Kirik, Revan's pseudo-dragon, and Wiakwa's franchise.
Once the groups are solidified, Argyle brings up the weapons that were left for the journeyman to enchant. Welby gives the party a nod and asks them to follow him. He leads the party through the workshop to a door in the back corner of the room. He pulls out a large set of keys and proceeds to unlock the door, opening it to a vault-like display room, with many different weapons and items. Welby explains that these are the items that the journeyman has found specifically for the party, and each of them gets to choose one. Argyle chooses a well-crafted rapier with runic writing etched into the blade. It's called the Guardian's Rapier, and this magic sword will allow him to teleport short distances at will. Atros chose a smooth, 3-foot-long rod that is continually shifting and changing in subtle ways. It's called the Rod of Mercurial Form, and it can shift into anything that can fit within a 5-foot cube. Sirius chooses a ring that looks as though it's been crafted from bone and is cold to the touch. It's called the Puppet Master's Ring, and along with a boost to his spell casting, gives him the ability to cast Speak with Dead. Glad chooses a circlet made from the scales, teeth, and hide of an ancient white dragon. It's called Gothia's Bane, and along with a boost to her spellcasting, it grants her resistance to cold damage and adds it to her melee attacks. I choose a giant-sized greatsword emblazoned with Bahamut's motifs. The sword is called Kanda's Fury, and this magic grants me extra force damage when using it. Revan chooses an amulet with celestial markings and wing motifs. It's called the Wings of Tabris, and along with a boost to his spellcasting, it grants him advantage on all charisma checks and saving throws. Wiaqua chooses studded leather armor covered in flame motifs and warm to the touch. It's called the Armor of Dis, and along with a boost to their armor class, it deals fire damage to anyone who attacks them with a melee attack.
The party decides to drop the stealth scout group first. Welby sets the course, and moments later the tavern's doors open into a dimly lit stone hallway. Shanks, Argyle, Wiaqua, Kyver, Atros, and Kyrich make their way into the space. They all agree to wait on the outcome of the negotiation to make any kind of move. As the tavern door closes, the rest of the party braces themselves for what is to come from their audience with the constable. Welby sets the tavern's course for the constable's hall. With their destination reached, Welby wishes the party luck as they exit the tavern. They walk into a massive hall that is at least 100 feet by 100 feet. Large pillars stretch up to the ceiling above, and expanding out in front of them is what seems to be an intricately carved glass floor over a frozen lake. Between each pillar is an armor-clad figure holding a shield and spear. Off on the other end of the hall is a dais on which a large throne and a cloaked figure is sitting upon it. The figure has a pale complexion with a slight glow to them. Galahad clocks the guards as some type of variation of Azamar. Galahad is the first to speak, requesting an audience with the constable. "State your purpose," he hears in response. Galahad explains the reason that they are there and the journeyman's supposed crimes. They are beckoned forward, and the group makes their way to the center of the hall. "So, you wish to free the journeyman. Do you know of his deeds?" the figure asks. "Do you know what this person is capable of?" The party concedes that they don't know, but are looking to find out and make amends.
"The extinguisher of whole civilizations, the murderer of entire worlds, the marauder of time. You wish to let him roam free," the figure responds. The party says that they didn't know of his crimes and that they believe he is trying to make amends for his past deeds. Their argument is persuasive, and the figure inquires how the party feels the journeyman should atone for his sins. Zex takes the lead and explains that the situation with Strahd and the land of Barovia, but the figure isn't swayed. The figure argues that the journeyman is the greater evil of the two, asking, "If you spare a single ant from under your boot and use the other boot to destroy an entire ant hill, do you deserve forgiveness?" Zex contends that small deeds add up, and fighting against evil, no matter the size, is worth doing. Unfortunately, his words fall upon deaf ears.
Zex asks what the constable plans to do with the journeyman. The figure responds that the journeyman will stay in his vaults and pay for every life he has taken. This confirms to the party that they are indeed talking to the constable and not someone lower in command. To what end? Zex asks. To his end, the constable replies. They begin to go back and forth about the difference between intent and action when Revan chimes in. Revan argues that all of the things the journeyman is accused of doing are arbitrary. These charges don't take into consideration the extenuating circumstances of the situation in which they occurred. Everyone, at some point in their life, must make decisions that don't have clear-cut answers. Looking directly into the eyes of the constable, he asks if he's ever had to decide, possibly having to cross the proverbial line that protects those that need protecting. The constable concedes that point made by Revan and asks if there is anything that can be done on the constable's behalf that would act as a penance for the journeyman's crimes.
Seemingly in the mood to bargain, the constable asks the group what they propose this deed should be. The party responds that they want the constable to tell them what a better alternative to imprisonment would be for the journeyman, but they must understand the type of bargain being made. The constable states, "I do not see a better alternative. I believe his punishment is just and right." Revan suggests that the constable let the journeyman free temporarily to help with ridding Barovia of Strahd. When the task is complete, they will then return him to the vaults. He agrees under one condition. Someone from the party must take the journeyman's place until the party returns. The party gathers together to discuss this new development. Revan turns to Franchise to relay the events thus far to the group in the vaults. Unfortunately, due to the odd setup of the pocket planes they are on, the message doesn't get through. As he realizes this, he hears the familiar voice of Kyrich in his head asking him what is happening. Revan relays the events to the other group, while the rest of the negotiating party discusses what to do. They eventually tell the council that they have someone in mind, but would like proof of life before they move forward. The constable responds, "That won't be necessary. The deal is such, you want the journeyman, and you leave someone here to take his place. And they stay here until he is returned. No ifs, ands, or buts." I question the constable's intentions if they're good or evil. The constable replies that good and evil have nothing to do with it. It is about the law. I offer to be a paragon of the law for the constable in keeping the journeyman to his word. Zex interjects with a question about where this law that is being spoken of comes from.
Rising from their seat for the first time, the constable makes his way down toward the party, flanked by his guards. Speaking directly to Zex, he says, "There is no higher power than the law." "And the law is you?" Zex questions. "I serve the law," he gets in reply. Zex decides to push for more information as the constable makes his way toward the group. Revan notices that there are white scales that are splotched across the constable's skin. He questions Zex on what he knows about the journeyman and himself, and what their powers and capabilities are. Zex asks again for some enlightenment, but is told that the only information that they need is the deal at hand. If they're lucky, the journeyman may tell them what is going on, but not to presume that they deserve an explanation for a situation that is above their heads. A faint glow begins to emit from around the constable. His eyes grow brighter and brighter, causing Zex to turn away from him. Galahad takes the lead again and informs the constable that they will find another way of completing their task, as they need everyone in their party to do so. They are given leave from the hall and begin to make their way out. On that way out, Revan turns to the group and says that he will stay to get the journeyman out. They all promise to come back for him, and Revan informs Kyrich that he is going to stay. Wiakwa thanks Revan and offers to take care of Kyrich. Revan turns back to the constable and tells him that he has decided to trade himself for the journeyman. But instead of acquiescing to the offer, the constable becomes enraged. He moves forward toward the party again, shedding his robes along the way, revealing more scales covering parts of his torso and arms. Standing in front of the party, he declares, "Here is the new deal. I take him," pointing to Galahad. "Or none of you leave here." Zex questions why, but is shut down immediately. The constable repeats, "Him, or none of you leave. You can all join the journeyman and ask your questions of him then. If you want to switch someone so much, then it is my choice. Or I take whoever lives, and you can join the journeyman." His guards begin to close in around the party.
Galahad looks at the party and tells them that this is not a fight they can win. Do what needs to be done to save Barovia. Zex promises that he will come back for him. As this takes place, Revan informs the other group of the turn of events. Wiaqua reacts violently and is subdued by the rest of the party. They calm Wiaqua down and tell them that they will break Galahad out. Galahad is then led out of the hall by several guards. Minutes later, the guards return with a woman with a dark complexion and the same clothes that the journeyman was wearing the last time he was seen. The constable looks to the party and says, "A deal's a deal. Now go." The party protests, saying that they don't know this woman, and she isn't the journeyman. The constable only smirks and tells them to leave again. The mysterious woman makes her way to the exit with a purpose. As the party enters the tavern again, the woman makes her way towards the journeyman's office as the rest of the party tries to stop her. Welby is called over, and after a brief and slightly heated discussion, she heads into the office. Welby assures the party that everything will be explained in due time. Zex and Revan try to confront the woman, but the door to the office is locked. Zex makes his way up to his room. As this is all happening, the entrance back into the tavern appears in the vaults, and the stealth party make their way back. Welby greets the returning group and tells them that there will be explanations soon. Roughly an hour later, the woman emerges from the office in a much better fitting set of clothes. Under her right arm is a holster and a book. Attached to her back is a wooden staff, and on her shoulder is a small creature known as an almirage, a rabbit with a horn on the crown of its head. She scans the room and asks for someone to grab Zex.
Shanks goes up to the second floor and grabs the ranger. She explains that she is the journeyman. They're hesitant, but eventually confirm through several means that she is who she says she is. The journeyman explains that they're a race called a Palangard. They come from the places in between planes there to protect them. She explains that if you were to walk out into a rainstorm and freeze time, each raindrop would be its own plane of existence, endless worlds scattered across a massive expanse. It is her and her people's job to protect those planes from disaster. Further, she tells the party that they come from different prime material planes. They're able to do this because of their incredibly long lifespans and their powers to regenerate. She speaks about the constable and how she was held for more than a century. The conversation turns to the supposed crimes that she was being charged with. She confirms she did those things, but it was more complex than good or evil, right or wrong. The weight of those decisions rests on her shoulders constantly. The party asks about where the constable comes from, but she truly doesn't know. He is part of a similar order to hers, but from another place entirely. It seems to be a meeting of an immovable object and an unstoppable force. The conversation turns to their plans to get me back. From potential layouts, defenses, and the potential accelerating timeline, Wiaqua brings up the last point several times and insists that they leave immediately to get me back. The party agrees and makes their way to the vaults. As they enter the dimly lit stone hallway of the prison, Wiakwa comes up with an idea. They'll cast locate object to search for my armor. With no ping from the spell, the group moves forward as stealthily as possible. Wiakwa turns to the group and suggests that they wild shape into something small to search ahead, try to get a ping from their spell.
Kuiper peeks his head into a doorway and sees the floor covered in crawling insects. He suggests that Wiakwa turns into a beetle. The druid, without hesitation, wild shapes into a beetle and zooms off ahead of the group. Through the hallways, Wiakwa buzzes with the party not too far behind. Almost immediately, Atrus's mercurial rod comes in handy. The party is able to expertly maneuver around obstacles, dismantle traps, and even ambush several roaming enemies. After finishing off a room full of orc warriors, directly after ambushing an earth elemental, and I shit you not, this actually happened, the party finds their way into an intricately locked door. Using their collective knowledge, they figure out that the two locks are being utilized, one mechanical and one arcane. Argyle and Sirius tag team the door, and with some effort, they successfully get it open. Wiakwa surges into the room, still in beetle form, and sees a set of half-plate armor, a massive greatsword, shelves of books, a cot, and a familiar but fairly older Goliath.
Perplexed, I stare at the beetle that buzzed into the room and landed on my shoulder. It had been 50 years since I'd seen anyone besides the guards who brought me food and my friend Bothok. It's strange for me, as I was just talking to Bothok when the door opened. Throughout my captivity, an older man named Bothok visited me. We conversed about many things throughout the years: religion, law, justice, philosophy, tactics, and more. Every so often, there would be an inkling in the back of my head that there was more to Bothok than what I saw. However, I finally saw what it was just as the door was opening and the beetle was flying in. Bothok was the avatar of Bahamut, there to help, comfort, and aid me in this time of sacrifice. Stretching out my hand, I watch the beetle skitter onto my hand, and a shard of memory pops into my head. The Genasi, the druid, they could shapeshift into beasts. "Are you Wiakwa?" I ask aloud. The beetle begins to jump and make noises, and across the room, a cat with wings appears. Franchise. The realization that I will be leaving now is at the forefront of my mind. The beetle flies back out of the room, and I begin to gather my things. The rest of the party comes into the chamber and sees the older version of myself donning my armor and sheathing Kanda's Fury.
The celebration is short-lived as the party realizes they must now get out of the vaults before they're caught. The race through the hallways and empty rooms until they find their way back to the place they begin their journey. In front of them, on the same wall as before, is the door to the tavern they originally came through. The journeyman steps up to the door and walks through it with the rest of the party in tow. There, a bright flash of light as they walk through the doorway, as they are transported into a forest clearing. At first, it's just Galahad, Sirius, and Arga in the tree-lined field. Something isn't quite right. A familiar voice creeps into their heads and says,
Thank you for coming back so early. Now, for my consolation prize for all the cheaters in the room. A fight to the death. They somewhat are confused by this and question the voice. The constable, out loud. Among us? Argyle asks. Yes, the voice replies. They refuse outright. Did you know we would come back? Sirius questions. I knew you were dishonest, the constable answers. We couldn't possibly have left our friends here, Sirius explains. That was the deal you made, the constable retorts. This back and forth continues for a bit longer when Galahad speaks up. Constable, enough with the games. Where are we? And where are the rest of our friends? Fight to the death. Why would we fight to the death with each other? Galahad yells. Because it's the only way you'll get to leave, the constable snarls in reply.
Shanks appears in the clearing. He receives the same message and rejects the idea of fighting to the death. Do whatever it is you wish, but you will not leave here until you fight to the death, or die of natural causes. Shanks begins to look around and assess the situation. He bolts into the woods, only to come back into the clearing, but from the opposite side of the forest. They're trapped in some sort of elaborate illusion. Once they come to realize this, Galahad ponders on the vast amount of knowledge that he's learned over the last half century, convinced that this is somehow a test. Galahad tells those who are there and appear that this battle to the death may be a metaphorical one. However unlikely, the constable may be speaking about battling inner demons and killing your past self. Though, in his estimation, this doesn't sound like something the constable would do or care about. The journeyman, who has just appeared with Zex, acknowledges Galahad's personal growth with a slow clap. Atros then appears, and the group begins to get antsy. Nothing seems to be happening. With every passing minute that goes by, the party hears in the back of their minds a whispered, "Fight to the death." Wiaqua and Revan appear in the field. Shanks decides to take a page from Galahad's book and contemplate the situation. With some deep thought and reasonable conjecture, he is able to suss out the connections of everything that just happened. This has all been contrived by the constable. It seems to be a lording of power over the group. What he is asking the party to do is what he truly wants them to do. Not necessarily that he wants the party dead, but potentially that they may be freed in some way.
Atros, sensing something similar, approaches Galahad and implores him to take his life. Galahad responds that he doesn't believe that this is what the test is. Atros says that they don't know what the test is and if this is real or in their minds. At this point, Shanks comes out of his inner thought and agrees with Atros. You're right. This is a test. Kyber appears in the clearing. Zex decides that he will be the one to sacrifice himself, and the rest of the party gives him a lot of grief. Enough with this hero bullshit. Let's just figure this out, quips Argyle. But Zex is convinced that he has to be the one that is taken out to prove a point about the death of a few to save the many. From the back, Sirius breaks into the conversation.
Sorry to interrupt everybody, because great things are going on, but I can't lie, part of me wants to know what you would do in this situation, Sirius asks, turning from the group to the journeyman. She looks back at Sirius and pauses to think. She then walks slowly over to him, looks him dead in the eye, pulls out her staff and says, I'd hedge my bets. And from out of nowhere, her staff flashes, and she strikes Sirius, twice.
A fight erupts among the party as the journeyman speeds away from Ceres toward Galahad. He catches her with Kana's fury, stopping her and using his backswing to trip her. Revan and Ceres join in the fray, casting Witch Bolt and Ray of Enfeeblement. Both the bolt of energy and the sickly black beam miss their target. Kyra looks very confused at the sudden acts of violence, but decides to join in anyway. Quickly making his way to the downed journeyman, he strikes her with bloodlust. Though she is hurt, the journeyman seems oddly happy about how things are going.
Shanks watches from his kneeling position and locks eyes with the prone journeyman. As he pulls back on his bowstring, she mouths, "Do it." He lets the arrow fly and strikes her between the eyes, killing her. He looks up to the sky and asks, "Does this satisfy you?" In the back of his mind, he hears a reply. "There's still 8 of you left." Sirius, still confused about what just happened and bleeding from his head, says, "Well, I wasn't expecting that answer," as he looks down at the journeyman's body. Shanks looks over to Sirius and quips, "It gets worse." 2 arrows fly at Sirius, pinning him to the ground, dead. Shanks then places his bow on the ground and puts his hands up. Atros walks over to Shanks' side, shouts, "Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitantly, then no longer," and casts Shatter Spell. A loud boom cracks and splits the air, downing the Kenku and injuring Shanks. Zex reaches out to the constable and questions whether or not he was right, that this is just an elaborate point that is being proven, that what the journeyman does is unjust and incorrect. "If you survive, I'll tell you," he hears in response. Zex activates the barrage feature on his bow. On the verge of tears, he releases a single arrow. 5 arrows make contact with Shanks' chest, grouping in center mass. Before the light leaves his eyes, Shanks gives Zex a thumbs up and mouths, "Nice grouping." Turning towards Wiaqua, he threatens the constable about being sure to keep his word, or there will be consequences. He lets a single arrow fly at the druid, and through some strange twist of fate, they caught it before it hits them with their teeth. Argyle rushes his way over to Zex. He asks, "How determined are you to do what has to be done? If you talk to this guy, to get answers about all of this." He unsheathes his rapier and runs himself through. He's unsuccessful at taking his life, though. Galahad, above these games, walks to the fallen tree. He jams Kana's fury into the ground with anger and pulls off his armor in a sign of non-participation. Wiaqua makes another threat to the constable while watching all of this violence unfold. "If this doesn't kill me, I want you to be the one." Revan calls to Galahad, shooting himself point blank in his chest with Eldred's blast. He isn't able to end it in one shot and drags himself closer to Galahad for him to finish the job.
Kyber asks the constable, "Last one standing?" He hears him reply, "I see someone gets the picture." Kyver smiles and just lays down, shouting, "I'm not standing." Zex looks to Argyle. "With absolute certainty, I will see this through." Zex strikes him twice with his bladed shortbow. "Damn, you couldn't do it in one hit," are the final words uttered by Argyle as he falls to the ground. Galahad stands and walks to Revan, helping him to the tree trunk. He asks, "Are you sure this is what you want?" Revan replies, "You see me bleeding? Make it clean!" Pressing the tip of his massive greatsword into his companion's neck, he severs Revan's head from the rest of his body. Calmly, Galahad walks back over to the fallen tree and sits back down. Kyver, decides to stay in his prone position, and Weaqua continues to taunt the constable. Zex turns his gaze at Kyver, and his single arrow turns into four. Three arrows hit, dealing a substantial amount of damage. Zex seems to be in extreme amount of emotional duress. Galahad calls to Zex, "I will not kill myself, but I won't stop you from doing what needs to be done." Zex breaks down in tears. Suddenly, a bolt of lightning strikes in between Zex, Galahad, and Kyver, hitting all three and killing Kyver. Zex immediately turns to Weaqua, who is still sitting on the ground, and fires three shots. Hitting on more than half, Weaqua is looking very injured. The druid calls another lightning strike on Zex, however, that is not enough to take him out. They get up and move away from Zex and Galahad. Zex pursues the druid and fires another barrage of arrows, hitting on most. With the look of a pincushion, they fall to their knees, taking in deep, gasping breaths. Weaqua is still alive, but barely. Galahad walks forward, takes out his javelin, and hurls it at the water genasi. His aim is true, and as Weaqua takes their final breath, impaled by the javelin, Galahad turns to Zex. Zex apologizes for the circumstances they're in, but Galahad tells him not to worry. They will see each other on the other side. Zex fires three shots, missing the first because of his trembling body. The second has four arrows release, with two misses and two hits. The final shot also has four arrows, and all of those hit their target as well. Even with six arrows in his chest, the Goliath still stands. Galahad looks into Zek's eyes, closing the distance, and says, "Don't kill me with the bow. I'll see you on the other side, my friend." He clasps Zek's forearm and stares into his eyes. The tabaxi drops his bow, saying, "Sorry that in the end I couldn't save you." And with tears streaming down his face, he releases his claws and buries them into the paladin's chest. Galahad falls into the ground, lifeless, as Zex looks around the scene of destruction that he stands in the middle of. Zex lets out a guttural cry. As he looks around, he feels a warm sensation in his chest and sees that his wounds are healing. From the trees, the constable appears in front of him, with a smug smile on his face. Zex races toward him, yelling, "Are you satisfied?" The constable only responds with the casting of a spell, as a crackling sphere of energy illuminates around him and then dissipates. "You're just gonna sit there with a smug smile after I just killed almost my entire party?" Zex rages. There's a tense back and forth between the two. The constable pokes and prods at Zex's emotions, constantly answering his questions with questions of his own. What few answers he does give are cryptic. He does confirm that he serves a higher power, and that what the party just went through was a punishment for breaking their deal with him. The heated discussion turns to Zex and his past, claiming to know all about all of their stories. It seems that the constable knows a great deal about Zex in particular. "You're repeating history. You were born to be a sacrifice, but you were saved. And now you walk right back into being a sacrifice. You're repeating history." Zex becomes impatient and confused. His demeanor shifts to something more confrontational than before. The constable feeds on this, pushing Zex more and more with taunts and bits of information. He begins to circle Zex in a predatory manner. The conversation has turned into a game of cat and mouse. Still, the constable presses Zex about his memories and why he doesn't have his early ones. With rage bubbling to the surface, Zex answers in a near roar, "I don't know. I don't know anything about my past. I wish I knew. I came here for answers, and now I'm here left with you telling me that I know something that I don't know." The constable chides him for acting like a petulant child and throwing a tantrum. He pushes harder, as if he's trying to awaken something. Zex's anger continues to build, but then he is given the name Oberyn. He recognizes the name, King Oberyn of the Sealer Court, patron of hunters and rangers, a figure Argo has spoken about on occasion. Zex presses for more, but is rebuffed. There is a pause in the conversation, and both feel that the time for talking is over. The constable throws his robes off and spreads dragon-like wings, leaping into the air as Zex opens fire on him. The two clash back and forth for a moment before the constable hits the ranger with a fireball, downing him on the spot. Zex opens his eyes to the sound of a strange thud. As his senses return to him, he realizes that he is suspended underwater in a cylindrical glass tank. And the thud noise that he's hearing are his party members trying to break it open. Thud. 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 Crack! Zex feels the pressure released as his group breaks through and pulls him out. Catching his breath, he's picked up by Shanks and Wiaqua. He sees the rest of the party, as well as the journeyman there too. She pulls out what looks like a pale purple, oversized river stone out of her pocket and smashes it into the ground. An eruption of light engulfs them, and they feel their bodies violently pulled to the center of the field of light. As it subsides, they look to see that they have returned to the tavern. Immediately after the ordeal with the constable, the party scatters to different parts of the tavern. Zex grabs himself a bottle and heads straight to his room. The rest of the party takes individual seats within the tavern area. Journeyman pulls Welby aside to the back for a private conversation, and Atros sees everyone off by themselves and beckons the party to speak about the traumatic experience that just occurred. The party agrees that everyone should be there to start talking, and Shanks makes his way up to Zex's room. The door is locked, and Shanks tries to break it down, but it doesn't budge, and Wiaqua makes her way up to the room with the protest of the rest of the party. They deftly pick the lock, look at Shanks, and walks back down to the tavern area. Shanks enters the room to a despondent Zex and tries to get him to come back downstairs. They have a tense conversation about a few of the more traumatizing events. Shanks ends it and walks back down to the tavern, leaving him to his drinking. Wiaqua, seeing that the mood is very somber, decides to create food with their magic for each particular party member. Shanks and Atrus decide to work out their frustrations by tinkering in the workshop. Galahad takes Zex's plate of food and takes it up to them. The Goliath sits down next to Zex and begins a conversation. They talk about how long Galahad was kept captive, the bombshells of information that the constable told Zex in their confrontation, his connection to King Oberyn, Galahad's supposed father, how he was able to take the lives of his party. Galahad tells him that he wasn't responsible for what everyone else did. He tells Zex that leaders are only good as the people around them, and that he should share his burden. Zex is reminded of Argo during the conversation, and the mood takes a turn for the better. Galahad reminds him that they still have a mission, people that they can help, that Zex can help. After they help Barovia, they can look toward the constable. As they speak, they hear a small voice in the room. It's Duo, and it seems that he's learning to talk. As the conversation is taking place, Atros and Shanks are working hard to refine the vial arrows that Atros had created not too long ago. In the tavern area, the journeyman reappears and asks the group to gather there. Glad and Wiaqua head out to grab Zex, Galahad, Shanks, and Atros. Everyone converges back in the tavern, and she begins to start fielding questions about the encounter. The subjects of past groups, the beings in charge of bestowing, quote, the law, the constable's appearance, the vaults they were kept in, and information that is potentially being kept from them, among others, are brought up. Eventually, Kyver starts to make his way over to the journeyman, asking if they've been watching the party longer than they've been together. She denies it as Kyver asks another question. How many versions of the party has she met? She tells the group that they are the only versions of them that she knows, going on to say that there are certainly other versions of them, but just running into them by chance would be very rare. Unfazed, Kyver continues his line of questioning. Why do I keep seeing these visions of death? He asks. The group is taken aback by this information, and they conclude that it is likely the realm of Barovia, twisting the things that they see and experience. JM asks if he's had any other visions, and he quickly replies that he hasn't. As a token of appreciation, the journeyman gives the party some information about their quests. Welby brings out a wooden box and opens it, and begins to start handing out small items and pieces of parchment. Things get pretty heavy fast. Kyver opens his parchment to reveal the floor plans of a manor, the home of the nobleman that killed his family and enslaved him. "Why did you give this to me?" the tabaxi asks. "I think you know the answer to that," replies the journeyman. Kyver begins to rock back and forth in his chair, a mixture of rage and fear in his eyes. The attention turns to Sirius as he opens a folded slip of parchment. While he doesn't reveal what it is on the parchment, it appears to be something that involves his deity, the Moonweaver, and dreams. Next, she hands Glad a small scroll. Opening it reveals a summons to the Seelie Court and a meeting with King Oberyn. The summons speaks of potentially dire consequences if this meeting is not attended, by not only Glad, but the realms at large. This catches the attention of Zex, who gives her a look of needing to speak with her at some point. For a second, she doesn't recognize the name, but then it hits her. King Oberyn is also known as the Green Man, her supposed father. Argyle is handed a scroll as well, reading it to himself. It is a mention of his mother and communication between nobles. This is the first bit of information he's received or found about his mother since the day she was taken and he escaped his captivity. He asks how old the scroll is and is informed that it's actually not very old. Next, she turns to Shanks and hands him a small pouch. It's a small key inside, and she tells him that he should go up to his room and turn the key from the inside until the symbol on the door changes from a wolf to an oak tree, then to walk through the door and take the key with him, as he will need it to return. He turns and makes his way up to his room. She looks to Wiakwa and hands them a folded piece of parchment, a symbol comprised of four intersecting triangles. Underneath are the druidic characters for D and C. They figure out that the symbols are a convergence of the four elements of the primaterial plane and druidic. They remember a bedtime story from their father when they were younger, a story about beings that created the cosmos called the Daughters of Creation. Wiakwa thanks JM for everything that she's done. With a nod, she turns to Atros and hands him a letter. He reads it to himself, reaching his hand up to his chest to clutch the pendant around his neck. "Quaff, oh quaff this kind Nephine, and forget the lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore," he cries as he crumples the letter. This letter is from his wife, Lenore, who, until this point, Atros had known to be dead, murdered by his former guild and the reason for his quest of revenge. She asks him to come back to her and rejoin the guild. "Prophet," I said, "thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil," he continues, tearing the letter in half. Zex receives something next from the chest, a sealed letter. He recognizes that this is Argo's handwriting almost immediately, and instead of reading his letter there, he decides to read it in private. The journeyman turns to Galahad and hands him a piece of parchment, and it contains the symbol of Bahamut and what seems to be some sort of code. He asks where she received this communication and is told that a cleric of the Platinum Dragon delivered it to the tavern specifically for him. While the party is given their bits of information, Shanks goes up to his room and follows the journeyman's instructions. Turning the key three times, he sees the symbol spoken of and opens the door. Pulling the key out of the door, he makes his way into a room of a similar size to his own. Several different short bows and quivers adorn the wall. The door closes behind him, and he is now alone. Looking around, a particular short bow catches his eye. It has been many years since he last saw this bow, and he makes his way closer to it. Next to it is a familiar dagger, so familiar that he begins to investigate it for markings that may confirm his suspicions. Right where he was expecting, he finds the letter D carved into the hilt in Elven script. He pulls the dagger off the wall, holding it and staring at it in disbelief. The door opens behind him, and instinctively, he makes ready for attack. From his position, he sees a slender, copper-skinned female, wood elf, with greenish hair, enter the room. And as she turns, there is a moment of recognition. "Donna?" Shanks asks in a slight and trembling voice. She meets his eyes, and a smile creeps across her face. "I didn't expect you back so soon," she says warmly. Shanks and Donna have a loving but confusing conversation. It seems that the person he was in love with so long ago and lost is here with him now, but in a different time and place. In due time and explanation, he understands what's happening. Donna always seems to find a way to explain things in a way that he'll get. Getting into his room, Zex opens up his letter from Argo. He speaks of a pact that he made a long time ago with a being he cannot speak the name of. However, he can give him a little bit of information about his past that he does know. He's from a place called Nymora. It's not a place that Argo has ever been to, but has heard of. And his only connection to it is a story of a cult to a deity known as the Cat Lord. This cult was raiding villages for sacrifices, and Zex's was one of them. He apologizes for keeping things from him, and hopes that the information he has disclosed will be useful to him. At the bottom of the letter are a string of letters. It's a lot to take in, and Zex looks to Duo, asking him, "I don't suppose you knew about this, buddy?" "Noms. Zex," is the reply he receives from his animal companion. After grappling with this new information, he heads back downstairs to get Duo some food and contemplates whether he wants to continue drinking or not. He grabs some food and another bottle, and Miyakwa sneakily casts Lesser Restoration on him before he heads back upstairs. Continuing past him, Miyakwa finds the journeyman and asks a few questions. When will they be receiving the weapons that they gave JM? Where will they be dropped off after they recover? And finally, if the journeyman would be willing to teach Miyakwa some hand-to-hand combat. She answers, soon, back at the winery, and that she would be more than happy to help Miyakwa. As the druid walks away from the conversation, Atros asks the journeyman where she got his letter from. She informs him that it was delivered to the tavern in an envelope with a wax seal emblazoned with the Telltale Guild's crest. This seems to weigh heavily on the Kenku as he thanks her and exits the room. The rest of the party disperses to their rooms for rest and recuperation. Atros makes his way into the workshop and begins to work on his homunculus servant, crafted in the visage of an owl. Argyle and Sirius make their way up to their rooms to rest, overwhelmed by everything that has just occurred. Kyver still seems out of it. He's now muttering numbers to himself. Galahad, fixating on figuring out the cipher that was given to him, stands up and heads to his room. Zex, restless, makes his way back downstairs and walks past Shanks, who seems to be in a very good mood. Pacing down in the tavern area, Zex is looking for something physical to do. He decides to go over to Kyver and slides the bottle of wine he took earlier to him. He hears 565-246 over and over. The other tabaxi doesn't seem to even notice that he's there. Zex gets back up and begins to wander around the tavern, looking for a place to train or to do something physical. Jinx walks over to him and suggests to start doing target practice in the tavern area on the far wall. They break into conversation about everything that just happened. Shanks pulls out his battle axe and asks, "Ever wonder why an elf carries around an orc axe?" He goes on to talk about how he grew up in a household that wasn't tolerant of others. His parents and tribe were murdered, and he was lost and alone. And at his lowest point, an unlikely father figure stepped into his life, an orc warrior named Jamri. Jamri explained that orcs and elves have a common ancestor, that they come from the same place. It was their diverging paths as people that made each of them what they are. Ultimately, this is what set him on the path he is taking now, deconstructing his prejudices and learning to see people as individuals and not as a preconceived notion that he once held for their entire culture. Zex laments that he went from having no information about his past to having more information that he knows what to do with, and that he doesn't know how much he can trust this information because of its source, at least regarding the constable. He speaks about the guild and Argo, and then poses the question, "Why do you think I would be suited for leadership to Shanks. The archer responds that he saw the qualities in Zex and that he needed to learn from doing, that mistakes are given, that he didn't get to where he was in his skill set because he made all of the right decisions. He got to where he is because of the mistakes and the bad calls that he's made. Failure is part of success, an integral one. As the two converse, the journeyman appears behind them. Zex asks if they're having trouble sleeping too. She tells them that it's difficult with a conversation going on outside of their room. Apologizing, Zex explains that they were just trying to find a place to exercise and work out. She points towards the stairwell that leads up to the second floor, and there's a door underneath it where there wasn't before. She says, "That's the place you want to go. It's all yours." As the pair gets up, Shanks gives the key back to the journeyman, telling her that he won't be using it again. She lets him know that she'll hold on to it for him, just in case he changes his mind. Zex asks for a conversation with JM and a few members of the team, including Shanks and Atros. The elf goes to look for Atros in the workshop, and he finds him sleeping. He sees a silver mechanical owl with a small opening in the center of his chest, sitting on a letter. In the artificer's left hand is a locket, the one he clutched earlier while reading the parchment, and it seems that it would be a perfect fit in the small cavity of the owl. Curious, Shanks reads the letter that the owl sits on. It is a reply to the letter that he received from the journeyman. In it, Atrus explains that he cannot rejoin and rebuild the guild, as they were the ones who killed her, that he must oppose her, and even in the face of his undying love for her, he concludes that if he must face her and kill her, along with the rest of the guild, he will then take his own life as well, so that they can be together again in death. Shanks leaves the room in shock. He informs Zex that Atrus is out cold and that maybe they should be waiting on that strategy meeting until the following day. Zex agrees and begins to head to the stairs with the journeyman. They chat about needing to speak to Argo as soon as possible regarding his letter. He asks about Nymora and why he lost his memories. They part ways, and Zex makes his way down into an expansive room with many different training areas. After an hour or so of target practice, Zex decides to sleep in the training facility. Over the last several hours, while the rest of the party was dealing with the information that was given to them, Glad has been on her own journey of discovery. To escape the chaos that is in the tavern area, she makes her way up to her room and lights incense as she begins to contemplate and meditate. As the incense burns to slither up towards her like a snake, she breathes in deeply and pushes the noise and distraction of the physical world aside. Opening her eyes again, she finds herself in the home that she once shared with her late husband, Theaticus. She moves her way out of her home and down to the path among the trees in the forest bastion. Bioluminescent purples, blues, and greens light her way as she walks through a natural hall of trees and plant life. Along the way, she looks over the seedlings planted in memory of those who have passed on or fallen too soon. Ahead of her, she sees a tall, slender, bronze-skinned, and golden-haired figure sitting in front of one of the seedlings. She approaches the figure, feeling that there is a familiarity to her. The figure turns towards her and smiles and stands to greet her. They tower over her, and at her eye level, she sees a familiar symbol hanging on the chain around their neck. It's at this moment that she realizes who stands in front of her, her god, the protector. Shocked, Glad cautiously asks for help. She explains the situation about the scroll she has received from the Sealy Court and about the party that she is part of. The conversation goes deeper as the protector asks her questions that spark new ideas and different outlooks. They speak of truth, family, and her husband's death. She takes in all that her god has to impart to her. The protector bids her a fond farewell and slowly vanishes from sight. She makes her way back up to her former home and sits back down on her prayer rug, closing her eyes. When she opens them again, she's back in her room at the tavern. Meanwhile, Galahad sits in his room going over the cipher, incredibly frustrated by the experience thus far. As he continues to work on this cipher, Argyle begins to dream of the day that his mother was taken from him. racing through the manner in which he was interred with his mother to see her being dragged into a carriage. He makes a move to go to her, but is restrained by two guards and is confronted by the head of the household, the nobleman. They exchange heated words, ending with Argyle spitting in his face. He manages to get out of the hold of the two guards and bowls the nobleman over, hands around his neck. He asks who his mother is being taken by, and through gasps for breath, the nobleman tells Argyle that the person is new in the area and his crest is a 13-pointed star made of swords. With this information, he lets go and races into the forest surrounding the property. He wakes up in a cold sweat and looks over to the letter on his table, eyes locking on the wax seal of a 13-pointed star made of swords. Argyle, though, is not the only member of the party that is experiencing strange dreams. Sirius has his own prophetic vision. Standing in what appears to be water, but he is somehow not sinking. The only light around him is that of a distant full moon. Not straying from the moonbeam in front of him, he walks to the edge of a precipice. From the moon glides an ethereal-looking elven woman. It's the Moonweaver, his patron deity. They speak of his faith, his journey, and the help that she wants to provide. As they finish their meeting, the Moonweaver reaches out to Sirius, touching his chest and filling him with comfort, warmth, and light. The following morning, the party makes their way slowly but surely back into the tavern. Wiaqua is the one first to arrive and approaches the journeyman, asking if they have a place to exercise their mind. The journeyman informs them that there is a library in the tavern and directs them towards it. And for hours, the druid scours the books within the large tower-like room. At first, they only find the children's stories that they know from their father at bedtime. But the longer they look and the deeper they search, they come upon a revelation. The Daughters of Creation are the focal points of an ancient and lost religion. They find renderings of mountains carved into cities, massive feminine effigies, and a temple deep within a chasm of a mountain. As the rest of the party convene and begin to eat breakfast, Wiaqua makes their way out of the library and walks to Galahad, who is still incredibly frustrated by the cipher. They offer to help the paladin, and Galahad tells them that this was given to him by his god, and it would be a disservice to not figure it out on his own. Wiaqua agrees and remarks anything else Galahad might want to address outside of the cipher. Galahad is unsure about what they're talking about, and the druid is a little hurt by this and decides to go get themselves some coffee. Meanwhile, Atros makes his way out of the workshop with a mechanical owl on his shoulder to sit at a table and start eating something. Shenanigans ensue with the rest of the party, and Shanks and Atros make their way quickly back into the workshop. As they make their exit, Wolby returns from the back with some coffee spiked with alcohol. The party is taking bets on what will happen when Wiaqua drinks it, as the druid has never had booze before. JM joins in on the betting right before Wiaqua downs the coffee and asks for another. The bettors double down, and the druid slams back another like a champ and asks for another. Argyle pipes up, "Hold the coffee," and the halfling obliges. Wiaqua pounds it and feels that something is off and tries to cast Lesser Restoration on themselves, but they aren't quick enough. They violently vomit right in between themselves and Welby, splattering the halfling. Wiaqua apologizes, then turns and walks over to Galahad shakily and pushes him. Galahad is not overly pleased with the current situation, so he places his hand on the druid's head, uses Lay on Hands to take away his drunkenness, and begins to walk away. This story arc started as something very different, but ended up being very solidifying for the party. Before this, the campaign was a lot of murder hoboing and dick jokes. I know you can't really tell from the last couple of ARC episodes, but trust me, it's there. This was a litmus test of sorts to see if we were going to go the route of lighter and funnier, or go hard into the more dark and traumatic, and the party chose dark. I
honestly couldn't be happier. If you have the opportunity, please check out our social media accounts on most major platforms. Just search for the Medusa's Cascade on the platform and give us a follow. We'll have art and animatics from the early phases of the animation project that has spawned from this campaign. It's some really cool stuff and definitely worth your time checking out. Also, if you're listening on a streaming platform, especially Apple Podcasts and Spotify, please take a few minutes to rate, review, and subscribe. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it does help get the podcast out there for other people to discover, and we all would appreciate the love and support. We'll see you next week for our Christmas one-shot, and in 2 weeks for the next ARC episode. Safe travels!